Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And Adam Boileau is back in the news seat this week. He'll be along in just a moment to have a chat about some recent developments in the security space. We'll also be hearing from Reuters' very own Chris Bing about his blockbuster report into ex-NSA mercenaries doing dirty deeds in the UAE. And Vice Motherboard's Joseph Cox will also tell us a bit about his experience reporting on cell phone location data sales. That's scandalous, that stuff. This week's show is brought to you by OstCyber. OstCyber is a non-profit funded by grants from the Australian government. Its goal is to promote Australia's cybersecurity industry. OstCyber CEO Michelle Price will be along in this week's sponsor interview to tell us about what they've got planned for RSA. OstCyber is running an RSA side event at the Minna Gallery, formerly known as 111 Minna. If you want to take a break from the convention floor, head on down to the Minna Gallery. You can get a nice coffee and be in a more relaxing environment. This is something you can do. The side event is for everyone, really. Potential customers of Australian firms, potential investors, even vendors who want to set up in Australia. You can head on down and speak with Australian government and industry representatives. And, I mentioned the good coffee already. You can just go down there and have yourself some good coffee. All of that is coming up later, but first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news. Well, the security news of the last 2 weeks, really, with Adam Boileau. And Adam, it's almost been 2 weeks since this story broke, but Chris Bing and Joel Shetman at Reuters, pumped out this absolutely blockbuster report about the so-called Project Raven.
Yeah, this was really quite a big story, and it broke, I think, maybe even an hour or two after we recorded the last news segment that we did. It was a bit rough. It's definitely a pretty big story. This covers a bunch of NSA, ex-NSA employees and contractors that ended up working for an American firm contracting into the UAE government to help them ostensibly stand up some defensive cyber capabilities, which was, the cover story. It turns out they're actually running the offensive capability for the UAE government. And this kind of ballooned over the time. They ended up being transferred off to a local UAE cyber firm, Dark Matter. And then running offensive ops for a foreign government, which is a funny place to find yourself, perhaps, as an American citizen.
Yeah, so what we got here is essentially a whistleblower named Laurie Stroud, who's ex-NSA and apparently is the person who recommended Snowden as a hire. I wouldn't admit that so freely, Laurie, if you're listening. But she makes for a really compelling source here because she's like, sometimes we'd have to drop malware on some 16-year-old because they said something mean about the king. But, it was just part of the job. Apparently her red line was when she discovered that other people in this organization were spying on American targets. It was like, hey, you're working for a foreign intelligence service. What did you expect?
Well, exactly. And she does come across as kind of a piece of work and, not particularly sympathetic in a way. But then, on the other hand, I guess you don't want a sympathetic source in a way. You want someone that sounds, kind of credible and, she does come across as extremely credible.
She manages to sound extremely naive and extremely cynical all at once. That's what makes her so weird, right? And it's just a hell of a story. Anyway, I actually asked Chris what he made of Laurie Stroud, and I also asked him what he thinks is going to happen next, and here's what he said.
It really is hard to wrap your head around. She said that she felt bad around the targeting of these human rights activists, these dissidents, some of these people that were just talking bad about the monarchy, but she said it wasn't her place to question it and it wasn't a red line for her. And so she continued to do it. And she felt like in the end, what she was passionate was about was doing counterterrorism surveillance, and that the targeting of these other people was kind of like a shitty part of the job, but it was at the client's request and she didn't want to question the client. And as she described, she actually enjoyed the job for a number of years. It wasn't until the targeting Americans that she realized that, how bad this had all gotten. I think what's going to happen next is the FBI has this ongoing investigation into Laurie's group and the companies that were involved in this. And their investigation is focused on two parts. The first is whether this group targeted Americans and hacked Americans. And then the second part is whether these former U.S. intelligence officials leaked sensitive material or tradecraft to Emirati intelligence. So we could see an indictment or criminal charges within the next year. It's really not clear. On the legislation side, I really would like to see the U.S. government take more responsibility and do further vetting on what these companies are doing overseas. But I just kind of feel like the U.S. government doesn't care, and I don't know if there's the political will to make changes.
So there you go. But I mean, what a crazy story. To me, this feels like what a lot of people thought the Snowden scandal was. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, seeing this kind of, you know, abuse of the power of these technologies, right, whether it be by government or by other organizations, you know, I guess was what a lot of people saw in the Snowden leaks, whereas here we do have a government, you know, targeting dissidents, targeting activists, targeting people that really there's just, you know, aren't a threat, you know, shouldn't be seen as a threat to a legitimate government. And it's hard not to, you know, look at it and go, well, you know, what business does American expertise have in assisting that? It's a bit gross.
Yeah, it is a bit gross. Bobby Chesney has a really interesting post up on Lawfare where he's like, well, do we need to change our laws here? And he made some really interesting points that hadn't occurred to me. One of them is, well, we can't just put a blanket ban on, you know, ex-intelligence community people working for foreign intelligence services, because quite often it is actually in America's interests to try to bolster foreign services, you know, that they're allied with, right? So it's you know, what to do here is actually a little more complicated than it might first seem.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. And I mean, thinking back to the conversation you had last week with Rob Joyce, I mean, the NSA going out and doing, you know, summer camps for kids and for teachers to really kind of go out and start to build that expertise. I mean, that recognizes the role of government expertise and agencies in building the set of skills. So then to then turn around and say, oh, well, now you can't go and transfer those skills into the private sector and then transfer those skills offshore. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of people who come to the US to work and, you know, obtain those, you know, obtain skills from that process and, you know, and vice versa, of course. So, we absolutely have to solve the supply chain of people and skills. And, you know, turning around and just putting a blanket ban on being able to move from the public sector into the private, you know, clearly isn't.
Well, I don't think anyone's proposing, you know, a blanket ban on people entering the private sector, but maybe not working directly for, you know, on contracts for foreign intelligence services might be something, you know, to at least look at where you want to draw the line there. Look, I think the most revealing quote in the whole thing from that source, Laurie Stroud, was the following. It was incredible because there weren't these limitations like there was at the NSA. There wasn't that bullshit red tape, she said. I felt like we got a lot of good work done on counterterrorism. And Laurie, I'm sure you did, but that red tape is actually there for a reason, so that you don't wind up putting people like bloggers in prison and dropping malware on 16-year-olds who said mean things about the king. But look, let's move on to a more current story. Oh, and I will say this. I've been in touch with Chris, obviously, about this work, and he tells me this is the first story in a series. So there you go. And, you know, Chris is a fabulous journalist. I don't know his colleague who he worked with on that story, but I'm very much looking forward to what else they're going to come out with. Now, look, this Jeff Bezos dick pic situation, Adam, what a wild ride it's been over the last week or so. Of course, you know, for those who've been hiding under a rock and don't know what we're talking about, you know, the tabloid, the National Enquirer, apparently got a hold of a whole bunch of private texts between Jeff Bezos and his mistress. And then, you know, Bezos and his wife announced they were getting a divorce and, you know, can open worms everywhere sort of situation. But then Jeff Bezos wrote this incredible Medium post where he published emails that have been bouncing between the National Enquirer and him, where, I mean, really what it looks like is the National Enquirer were trying to blackmail him to get him to stop suggesting that there was a political motivation behind their reporting on his affair. And these emails actually contain some pretty detailed descriptions of the images of Bezos that are in their possession. And he published it. He just called their bluff and said, I won't be blackmailed, which was awesome. And just one of those wild signs of the times, right? Oh, and it led to the best headline I think I've ever seen, which was from the New York Post, which, you know, because David Pecker is obviously runs AMI Media, and the headline was Bezos exposes Pecker, which I think, you know, I mean, puns are lazy writing, but this was amazing. I mean, what did you make of this whole story? I mean, there were even insinuations in Bezos's post that somehow the Saudi Arabian government was involved.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that's craziest about this, right, is that we are sitting here having a conversation, a serious conversation about the geopolitical implications of Jeff Bezos' dick pics, which, like, that's a weird timeline. But no, I mean, I think the, you know, Jeff Bezos, you know, showing up and making that post, I think, you know, bought him a lot of respect that, you know, that he's standing up to bullies and that he's, you know, really taken, you know, taken a pretty, you know, I guess, principled stance on it, which, and not, you know, letting himself be blackmailed, which, you know, there's a lot of people who have a lot of criticisms about Jeff Bezos and about Amazon, about workplace relations and, you know, the employment practices of Amazon as a company. But, I mean, having someone stick a middle finger up at, you know, a tawdry tabloid outfit like The Enquirer, I think a lot of people are quite happy about that in a way. And I mean, the political aspects of it are strange. The Saudi aspect of it is strange. I mean, I guess the suggestion there is the Washington Post, obviously is owned by Bezos, you know, was the one of the employers of Khashoggi, and that points to some intent by the Saudis. But then, of course, the story developed into the, like, the brother of the mistress is Trump, you know, like a wild Trump supporter. And the suggestion seems to be that he leaked these pictures to The Enquirer. I mean, what kind of, I mean, if that's true, what kind of brother steals his sister's sexts and leaks them to the media? Like, what kind of piece of work do you have to be to do that?
Well, a radicalized one, you know, I'm guessing, like, sort of politically radicalized. But look, I just want to backtrack on something you were talking about there, which is that, you know, Bezos did show courage in just, you know, publishing what he published about his nude photos. And I do think he deserves credit for that. But let's not get carried away. He's one of the most powerful men in the world who can deal with that, right? Like, it's not going to cause him that much damage. And I think we've got to be careful about saying that this is an amazing template for everyone to follow. I think it's a vastly different situation for any woman. Let's just say that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly not everyone can hire, you know, world-class private investigators to manage their investigation of you know, of their nudes being leaked, which, yeah, as you said, very few people are in that position. And, yeah, very few people are
I think
privileged to do that.
Look, I think tangential to that, no one really wants to see Jeff Bezos' nudes, right? Well, so it's not like, you know, it's just a different sort of situation. So he took that option. He was able to do that. But I think for a lot of people who find themselves in similar positions, they don't have that luxury, right? And I think we've got to remember that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That is the case. And of course, I mean, the Enquirer is known for, you know, the sort of the catch and kill program where they go and buy a bunch of stories and then kill them to, you know, protect Trump, I guess, is one of the examples we've seen used. And so with this, you know, using this kind of stuff as currency, as leverage, as negotiation is just, you know, it's just a shitty business practice that no one should have to be involved in.
Well, and they're kind of on a good behavior program with prosecutors, right, because of their catch and kill stuff. So, and it looks like that what they were doing, you know, may well have been illegal just in terms of the blackmail element. So, look, just a wild story. I mean, we had speculation that the Saudis were somehow involved. We had people digging through data breaches and they found, you know, the mistress's login credentials in a data dump and speculated that maybe it was some sort of cloud backup. Sorry, I should stop referring to her as the mistress. It was Lauren Sanchez. That's the woman's name. So yeah, it was just one of those unusual circumstances where InfoSec and popular news just collided. But look, in the end, it looks like it was the brother, right? Which is just, you know, Occam's razor, I think.
Yeah, unfortunately, in a way, I mean, it would almost be easier if it was nation state, you know, Saudi-backed hackers, you know, iOS zero-daying someone's phone as opposed
That would have been
to,
awesome. You know, awesome.
Exactly. That would be a much better story than, oh, the brother is just a creep.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Turning our attention to Wired now, and Lily Hay Newman has a great story here. You know, I'd call it more of a feature than a news story, but, you know, the gist of it is that everybody's sort of scrambling in federal government departments now to do catch-up work after the shutdown because, you know, patches weren't applied, you know, logs weren't examined, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, having the government, you know, on skeleton staff for as many weeks as it was, I mean, obviously it was going to have some consequences. From the outside, we saw the TLS certificates expiring and that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, the story makes quite a good point about how much, you know, if you come back to work at a SOC after 3 weeks of no one reading the logs and you've got all of that backlog to get through and then also try and investigate in an environment that hasn't been actively looked at for a while. Like, that's pretty challenging. And I imagine it was already a challenging job, rolling incident response in government, let alone now with a 3-week backlog. Although she makes the quite funny point that, on the plus side, because no one was at work, there'll be less people to click on the fishes. So that's good.
Yes. Glass half full. I fully support this mindset. That's great. Krebs has a very interesting story here.
Yeah, no, this story is about a bunch of, a phishing campaign targeting people who are like bank fraud officers that are covered under a particular, there's a mechanism in the US called the Bank Secrecy Act, where banks and government can kind of share information about fraudulent activity. Anyway, someone phished all of these, specific offices at a bunch of banks around the credit unions around the US. And then the question was, well, where did that list of targets come from, because some of the emails were addressed correctly, with full names and things. So, kind of single source led people to, well, maybe it's one of the, agencies that manages the list of, the list of people that handle these requests and stuff. And yeah, it's all turned into rather a curious case of, where it came from. There's a lot of finger pointing and no one's saying, we got ourselves owned or we leaked our information. But yeah, very targeted phishing and probably, I imagine, quite effective.
Yeah, and the finger is squarely being pointed at the National Credit Union Administration, which is an independent federal agency that insures deposits at federally insured credit unions. I imagine they would have some juicy email addresses for someone who wanted to run a phishing campaign.
Yeah, I'm sure the North Koreans will help themselves to all of the money. Yes, that's their thing. There's no attribution that it was North Korea. I'm guessing. I'm speculating. I got no doubt.
Now, Russia is planning a somewhat odd exercise, Adam.
Yes, Russia apparently is going to unplug themselves from the global internet and, presumably make sure, A, that they can still have any functioning infrastructure when that's the case, and B, that the mechanisms for routing traffic through the Russian, government organs that are going to facilitate this function correctly, which, sounds rather a lot like let's test run our, Great Firewall of China equivalent and make sure that we can handle all the traffic, make sure DNS still works. On the other hand, I kind of wish that more countries would consider what's going to happen when the tubes go away.
I'm so glad you said that, right? Because I'm just thinking in terms of a preparedness exercise. If I'm Russia and I'm thinking, look, everyone's pretty angry at me because of all of the bad things I've been doing on the internet, what would it look like if all of a sudden we couldn't route? Doing this sort of exercise seems prudent.
I mean, like in New Zealand, for example, we have, 3 undersea fiber cables now. I mean, okay, one of them's a loop, so that's nice. But, I mean, until recently, we had essentially one high-capacity cable in and out of the country. Someone puts a boat anchor through that, everything cloud is going to stop working here. And that's not a thing as a country we are willing to think about to the extent that we would go turn off that tube and see what happens. I'm kind of jealous in that respect of Russia being willing to consider doing this and, to have the then technical capability to be able to run the internet without, the root DNS servers being available, for example, or the, what that's going to mean for CIE validation and, cert checking and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, I'm interested to see how well it goes.
Yeah, me too. And I think one of the interesting things about this is it's been reported as this is part of some huge censorship clampdown. I don't think even the Russian government, I don't think they would get away with this level of clampdown, right? So let's see. I think this has more to do with resilience planning and planning for, that bad day that could possibly come one day when Cyber Command decides to kick them off the internet.
may well happen.
Yeah. So Australian Parliament House had a password reset over the last week.
Yes, which of course is an interesting story if you're an Australian. Definitely, the suggestion seems to be that there was an intrusion there, and you don't ask people to reset the passwords for no reason. Whether or not China was involved seems to be that there's a bit of sort of gossip around whether that is actually the case. No one's being kind of straight up saying it's China yet.
No, but I mean, you got the ABC reporting that there's a possible China link. I mean, saying that they're okay, but I will tell you this, right? I do have a snitch in Parliament House, and the day this broke, Mike Burgess, who's the head of ASD, was seen wandering the corridors with Alastair McGibbon, right? So, right. Yeah. Yeah, right? Like, this tells you that it's being taken seriously, and I don't know. I mean, look, ASD does incident response in incidents like this, right? So even if it was a crime gang or whatever and had nothing to do with state behavior, you might still see Mike Burgess wandering around, although I suspect maybe someone a little bit below him. Just, yeah. Just my feeling, if it was kids. But yeah, look, it's not the first time the Australian Parliament House network has been attacked, and it will not be the last, but certainly caused a stir. Now, Eric Geller over at Politico has what looks to be a bit of a scoop here. I mean, time will tell if he's right, but he wrote last week that Trump is likely to sign an executive order banning Chinese telecom equipment from US builds sometime this week. So that could be interesting and a bit of an escalation.
Yeah, I mean, a blanket ban, and we don't know the specifics yet of what's going to happen, but a blanket ban on Chinese equipment would be a pretty strong signal. I mean, like, say, in New Zealand, the example of Huawei being, what was reported as a ban was really, one specific network architecture rolled out in a particular provider was not approved, as opposed to a blanket ban. So a blanket ban would be a pretty clear message. A suggestion seems to be that they're going to announce it ahead of the Mobile World Congress, kind of cellular industry shindig in Spain later this month. So we'll have to see how that unfurls. Doing that right before the big, trade event, I guess, is going to send a pretty clear message to all the people who are off considering business deals and stuff.
Talk about rubbing it in. Signing it right before that sort of powwow, I mean, that's the ultimate that's the ultimate pissing in the punch, really, isn't it?
Well, it certainly is. And if you're the sales guy from Huawei, thinking about how you're going to go close some deals during this, you're going to be rubbing your temples and going, oh, for God's sake. but yeah, if you're, Cisco or Ericsson or, Alcatel-Lucent, Nortel, Nokia Networks, whatever they're called now, you're going to be rubbing your hands together, I guess.
Yeah, that's it. Well, Huawei will always have Iran. Just remember, they'll always have a run. Now, look, staying with Huawei and Bloomberg Businessweek, not known for consistently breaking entirely truthful articles, but this one has the ring of truth about it. It's a fascinating story here about a company in America, small company, that has developed some sort of synthetic diamond-coated glass. Now, this material has military applications as well as civilian applications. The civilian application is, of course, that it can be used for cell phone screens. Huawei approached the company and asked them to urgently be sent a sample of this material. Now, under ITAR restrictions, the sample couldn't leave the US, right? And they couldn't do any destructive testing of it. They boxed it up. They sent it to them. It comes back way like over the time that, they were supposed to have it for a set amount of time. It came back, way late and had apparently been blasted. They worked this out later that it had apparently been blasted with a 100 kilowatt laser, which suggests maybe their testing was a little bit destructive after all. And, the FBI has been involved. There's been people wearing wires to meetings and all this crazy stuff. And the reason we know about all of this is because the company wanted to tell its story because they were like sitting in a meeting at a conference with Huawei people like wearing a wire and brushed off another potential customer, and they sort of needed to explain why they've been a bit weird lately, right? Like, I mean, where do you even start with this story? It's wild.
That's a hell of a conversation to have to go have with a potential customer. Oh, like, sorry, we gave you the brush off because we were busy in an FBI sting against the Chinese competitor of yours. But yeah, it's a really interesting story. And of course, we've seen the Tappy the Robot story of Huawei industrial espionage. Seeing another
You just love using his name, don't you, Tappy?
I do. Tappy the Robot, such a good name. But yeah, I mean, another Huawei industrial espionage story, I guess, is a good thing. To see out in public, because I mean, having concrete examples that we can point to when we're having the conversation about Huawei, I think is really useful. But yeah, this one is just it's interesting seeing the cloak and dagger aspect of it, of course. But yeah, I mean, it's just also how mundane in a way this kind of espionage is. Just understanding how thick is the diamond coating, how is it applied, all that kind of thing, and then obviously the ITAR aspects are interesting, shipping it off to China. Because actually, one of the things they recorded on the wire was the fact that they had shipped the sample to China when they weren't supposed to.
Well, they needed to take it to their 100 kilowatt laser. They didn't have one of them lying around in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, didn't have that in their pocket, spare pants.
That one's definitely worth a read. A link to that one is in this week's show notes. Also, staying in China, they have apparently updated their cybersecurity laws. This one allows government hackers to basically just penetrate any network within China, within China, and just do like free pen tests. Yay! They're even allowed to search networks for like prohibited data and stuff. It's crazy.
Yeah, this is is pretty nuts, to be honest. Like, I read the story and then I went back and I had to read it again because I'm like, this can't be, like, they can't be serious about this. And it appears that they are. This is the updated regulation on internet security supervision and inspection by public security organs, which apparently is going to give the Internal Security Service, the Ministry of Public Security, the ability to remotely compromise, they call it remote inspections, of network security defenses, but also to check for prohibited content, help themselves to stuff. And then, you know, they describe it as, you know, performing penetration tests to check vulnerabilities, but there's also no mechanism or requirement that they then tell the people that they have inspected, that they have been inspected, and share any results with them. So, yeah, it's pretty much we can remotely own your stuff and have a rummage around, and there's nothing you can do about it. And it applies to any was internet service provider with more than 5 computers on the internet in China.
Yeah, I caught that part as well. All of
everybody.
Them. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just yeah, it's the sort of loopy stuff we've come to expect from modern China. Google has, apparently uncovered 2 iOS PrivExes that have been exploited in the wild. Now, immediately I've got questions, right? Which is, how does Google know that these PrivExes have been exploited in the wild? Someone must have tipped them on some applications that were doing funky stuff, like some apps that were in the App Store. They must have grabbed them and maybe reverse engineered the exploit. That's the only thing I can think of here.
Well, I mean, the other option is they were used in the wild against Google. Google employees, Google affiliates, and they got hold of it through, you know, running incident response of their own. And obviously, Google has been a big target for a lot of people over the years. So that's another avenue. Of course, Google, you know, having a copy of the internet is pretty helpful. Certainly plenty of ways Google stumbles across this stuff. But yeah, when Ben Hawkes posts, you know, about sweet bugs being used in the wild, like, you kind of take that guy seriously.
Yeah, you do. What do we know about the bugs, apart from the fact that they're PrivExes?
I don't know that we've seen specifics of them. One of them relates to the, like, iOS Foundation framework, which is, you know, a pretty generic thing. The other one's with IOKit, which is sort of, you know, the general network inter-process communication framework. Once again, like, pretty generic, and I haven't seen, real specifics about what the bugs are, but yeah, at least Apple is apparently patching them along with the rather stupid FaceTime bug that we talked about a couple of weeks ago.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, the people they're crediting here is, one of them is from Google Threat Analysis Group, and then you've got Project Zero people. So I'm guessing this was a team effort. But yeah, very interesting when they're out there squashing bugs that are actually being used in the wild. Okay, this next story is so close to being funny, but unfortunately it is not funny because it involves the death of someone who is quite young. That said, this gentleman ran a cryptocurrency exchange and didn't really do much of what I would call succession planning.
No. This guy, Jerry Cotton, was CEO of Quadriga CX, which I gather is one of the larger cryptocurrency exchanges in Canada. Apparently went on holiday to India, carked it, apparently of Crohn's disease, which, I mean, I know a few people who aren't really into the wheat, and like dying of that seems pretty, I mean, it's not super normal.
No, it's a thing that can happen. I saw someone else saying that, and then like they got shouted down by angry people who have Crohn's disease. So, you know.
All right, fair enough.
You learn something new every day.
You do. Apparently he had the bulk of the assets of this exchange in a cold wallet, which, you know, on one hand, good job, guy. You didn't have all of your assets in the hot wallet to get immediately stolen. Downside was the cold wallet was, or at least the key material for the cold wallet was on his laptop, which was full descryptoed. And yes, he passed on without having communicated this rather important $140 million worth of key material to anybody. And something like 0.5% of all Ether is now bricked forever. So, yeah.
Well, it's funny, right? Because I wonder how much cryptocurrency has been marooned this way. Because I one situation I found myself in during the whole boom was I had a few people get in touch with me via friends of friends of friends, that sort of thing, right? And they'd say, I bought, you know, $200 worth of Bitcoin like 8 years ago. It's now worth, you know, 110 gajillion dollars, but I can't recover it. And, one guy even sent me like his wallet file from this obscure software, and I had to do, you know, do all this weird shit to try to pull material out of it. And in the end, I figured out that it was actually like a fresh wallet that he installed over the one that actually had. Yeah, all right. So, and I think that was, that would have been about a quarter of a mil in Bitcoin. And the guy was like, he's like a plumber, you know what I mean? It would have been life-changing, completely life-changing for most people. But yeah, I just wonder how much cryptocurrency is in dead wallets or has been dev-nulled.
Yeah, well, clearly quite a lot. And yes, there's a lot of people who are very sad, I'm sure, about this particular exchange going. Really, what is the natural kind of life cycle for cryptocurrency exchanges? It seems to take everybody's money and then, you know, either steal it or, you know, just black hole it, as is the case.
Or have it stolen from you, you know, like that seems to be pretty popular as well. Yeah. Now, look, speaking of people having bad days, this company VF Email, who I got to be honest, I'd never heard of them before, right? And they don't have that many Twitter followers. So I don't know. I'm guessing they're not the biggest company in the world, but yeah, they're not having a good time.
No, somebody owned their boxes, all of their boxes, it seemed, and just filled all the disks with Dev Zero. Zero filled disks, all the backups gone, all the boxes gone, everybody's mailbox is gone, and yeah, pretty much that's that for them.
Yeah. You know, the only other time I can think of this happening, it was that Australian company, Distribute IT. I think this situation is going to wind up on a lot of PowerPoint slides.
Yeah, I mean, everyone loves a good example like this. And yes, lots of, you know, risk execs will, I'm sure, see PowerPoint presentations with this given as an example, along with, you know, Maroochy Shire Dam and, you know, the other, you know, well-named examples of, you know, the tip of the cybers that we see.
Dude, Maroochy Shire Dam just became like a non-thing after Stuxnet. Right, because until Stuxnet, that was the one. Some people listening, you know, I'm guessing a lot of people listening wouldn't even know what we're talking about when we talk about the Maroochy Shire incident. But it was when some, you know, disgruntled ex-employee of a local government in Queensland, not too far from where I live, you know, a few hours drive sort of thing, you know, he got the shits and used custom RF equipment to flood local creeks with sewage, right? So this was the one example of like a high impact ICS hack that everyone could point to. And then Stuxnet happened, and of course that became the new go-to. But any idea why these people got owned, how they got owned?
Yes, we don't really know. I mean, one of the things that sort of stood out to me in the story was they appear to have been running Horde, which was a, you know, open source mail package, like webmail and other mail infrastructure package, which, I mean, has to be 15, 20 years old at this point. So that's an obvious, you know, avenue that I would consider where one of my targets to go in through. But I mean, this kind of shared hosting provider, or, you know, hosting providers that run this kind of stuff, I mean, there's just so many ways to mess it up. And
yeah,
we don't really know whether they were ransomed or, you know, they just pissed someone off, or whether it was opportunistic. We just don't know. I mean,
yeah, someone might have just done it because they could, right?
Yeah, I mean, we just don't know, Ryan. We don't know.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Bad luck for them. And it's an interesting thing around, you know, SSDs, right? Because they're everywhere now. They're even in data centers. And once you delete data from an SSD, guess what? It is gone, just because of the way they map data and do wear leveling and stuff. So, yeah, that's something to keep in mind when you're planning for disaster recovery. Now, look, I only want to talk about this one super quickly just because it is just such a gimmicky hack, right? Someone has encoded like an exploit essentially into a strand of DNA that when analyzed by a particular, you know, DNA sequencing or whatever, you know, whatever the correct terminology, DNA analysis software, you know, it trips some file format bug and gives them shells, right? Now, of course, this did the rounds like you wouldn't believe on the, you know, on the every form of social media you can imagine, with people going, oh my God, people have put, you know, an exploit in DNA. But really, this is just kind of stunt hacking, isn't it?
It is, unfortunately, just kind of stunt hacking. And it's pretty stunty, which is great.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, they, you know, the piece of software that they are exploiting for this, which is like a compression thing that compresses sequence DNA output, like they coded the bug into it themselves as a proof of,
you
know.
Oh, really? I didn't even get to that bit, man. Come on.
Yeah, like
that's lame.
They wrote their own bug into the compression software that's specifically crafted to then allow them to be able to trigger this. So it's a bit, I mean, you know, it is a buffer overflow. You know, it's a bug class that's believable. But yeah, like that fact that this end-to-end chain is essentially crafted the whole way, it was lost in a lot of the reporting.
Let's put it this way. I don't think anyone who's listening to this needs to call an all-hand meeting to address this threat. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, not so much.
Yeah. Now, okay, we've got a good one here from Ars, written by Sean Gallagher, which is Google has released its own Chrome extension that alerts people to breached passwords. Now, the reason I find this interesting is Firefox, as I understand, is already doing something kind of similar, and they're using Have I Been Pwned? They're using that data set. Google's got their own, and this I can't imagine this is music to Troy Hunt's ears, to be honest, because, you know, they've gone and rolled their own.
Yeah, and I mean, to be honest, Google's in a really good position to do that. I mean, much more so than Troy is in a way. I mean, maintaining that data set, doing it in a way that's robust and protects, you know, what is quite a juicy target in a way, you know, that's a complicated task and perhaps something that's better suited to, you know, to a Google rather than an individual. You know, obviously Troy gets a bit of help doing it, but I mean, you know, it's a kind of a Google scale problem these days. And then, of course, there's also the acquisition of this data, like getting password breaches, you know, is the sort of thing that Google's very well placed to do by virtue of, you know, of their already crawling all over the internet anyway. So I'm not surprised. I mean, Google's the sort of place that would have had this skunk worked internally for their own use anyway, and then bodging it up to a browser plugin kind of makes sense. And I think there's a lot of people for whom, you know, a Google doing it is more viable than, you know, than Troy.
Yeah, I mean, I have been expecting someone to buy Have I Been Pwned, basically, like for this purpose, right? So I was kind of surprised to see someone else had put in the work to do this. That's what I find interesting about it. Like, this has become a validated approach.
Yeah, and they are talking, perhaps there will be some other ways that they would make it available for more general use. Obviously, there's a bunch of considerations around that as well. But yeah, we may see you know, some other things built on top of this data set if they do decide to share it widely.
Joseph Cox has continued reporting. I mean, this, you know, Joe is like a journalist miner who has hit a rich vein of gold here, because he's just been pumping out stories on this cell phone location data stuff. The latest one says that, you know, these telcos were selling GPS, like customer GPS data that's typically used in emergency situations for when authorities have to locate like car crash victims and things like that. I mean, this is rising to the level of scandalous.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I mean, some of the previous stories have talked about, you know, kind of cell location and you know, fairly, you know, more rough location. But this reporting is about the assisted GPS data, which is the really kind of high precision stuff that's, you know, really only ever meant for emergency services. And the idea that the carriers would just, you know, kind of aggregate this up and sell it with the rest of their location data to data brokers is just, you know, completely unacceptable. And I mean, you would imagine that, you know, both the American consumer and, of course, the FCC would be all over this. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just entirely unacceptable and outside of what people would expect.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, right? And I mean, even the original report that Joe published on Motherboard, I mean, real estate agents and car salesmen were getting access to this type of information, right? So I asked Joe what his feelings were through breaking this story, and also whether or not he's been surprised by the level of political reaction there's been to this, because there has been a pretty serious reaction in the US. Here's what he said.
So when I first started looking into this, it was just one company called Microbuilt that was providing to bounty hunters, and I knew one, possibly another one. So that was on a relatively small scale. I didn't anticipate there would be another company selling to something like 250 bounty hunters. But then, of course, two independent sources on top of that also said that some people who were getting data that way were then reselling it to those without authorization. So there's almost this other layer that we can't quite quantify either. And of course, even if we have the 250 bounty hunters, there is also the used car salesmen and the landlords that Microbuilt, the first company, also advertised this data to. So even though we've uncovered something of a larger scale than we originally anticipated, it's likely only going to get bigger as well. I've been a little surprised by the political reaction. Of course, Senator Ron Wyden was always going to comment and respond to this strongly, because it's an issue that he's been over for, I mean, years now. But then when we had 15 senators, including, you know, Kamala Harris and Bernie Sanders and various other people coming out against it, I mean, I wasn't anticipating that. The FCC's reaction of saying that, look, we're going to investigate, we are investigating, even though they don't specify whether that includes particularly the bounty hunters, I'm not particularly surprised by the FCC's feet dragging over this. I mean, they've had meetings with these location aggregators. They've been aware of other companies that have abused this sort of data access and data selling. So it's just part of the course for the FCC. But of course, now the government shutdown has ended, maybe that investigation can actually get somewhere.
Yeah, so I've linked through to some of Joe's reporting there, and it's worth checking out. I mean, you know, they've been reporting that some of these bail bond companies tracked, you know, they ran tens of thousands of location queries against people. So it's just wild. Joe Cox and his colleague Jason Kobler also have a great story about the whole ecosystem that sprung up around unlocking iCloud locked phones. Now, in Australia, what this looks like at the moment is people threaten to stab you unless you turn off Find My iPhone and disable iCloud when they're actually stealing the phone. You know, we saw similar trends when car security got better. Instead of people having their cars boosted from their driveway, like, they're more likely to get clubbed over the head and have their keys stolen. Same sort of thing, right? But there's a whole, like, multiple layer crime ecosystem around doing things like spear phishing people whose phones you've stolen to get them to give up their iCloud passwords and stuff like that. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It's really interesting insight to, you know, I guess how that criminal motivation ends up working. You know, the fact that there are whole secondary markets for, you know, specific phishing kits for managing, you know, getting the creds for all of your stolen devices. Plus, of course, the way that it feeds into the secondhand, like, parts supply chain, where you do have locked devices and you can't unlock them, then you can sell them onwards for parts. I didn't really understand that aspect of the business. So, yeah, certainly worth reading for anyone who is interested in, you know, that kind of, you know, crime ecosystem business model sort of stuff that sprung up around Apple's products.
Speaking of iPhones, and Facebook had a bit of a tense moment last week when Apple actually revoked their developer cert because apparently Facebook was using it to sideload some really creepy privacy invading app. This is their VPN thing where they were paying like teenagers $20 a month to use it so they could analyze their data. And I think Apple had already kicked the app out of the App Store, and then Facebook were like sideloading it using their enterprise cert. So they... that got revoked. I mean, just crazy, right? It's been restored since. They got a new one, but wow.
Yeah, it was a pretty wild story, this one, because I've been seeing this sort of shootout between Apple and Facebook, and then also it turned out Google as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Was just a really interesting exercise of Apple's power. I don't think a lot of people expected that they were going to actually pull the trigger, and we're kind of glad that Apple decided that this was worth, you know, pulling the trigger on revoking their enterprise cert, which of course means that, you know, a whole bunch of internal development on internal apps and all of their internal, you know, whatever, you know, the app that lets you order your lunch at the Facebook cafe or whatever, you know, all of a sudden stop working. So it's a pretty, you know, clear message for Apple to send to these companies to take them a bit more seriously about it. But yeah, it didn't last too long before they issued a cert with a new one that had, you know, then revoked the specific applications and allowed them to carry on with, you know, app development. But yeah, the same thing happened to Google, you know, with a sort of a day later, once people started looking into what the Facebook app did, why Facebook got pulled, and then finding, you know, going and ferreting out equivalent things from Google where they were sideloading outside the organization, you know, against the terms and conditions of their enterprise cert with Apple.
The pushback against the worst aspects of Australia's assistance and access bill is getting pretty organised. We've got this group called Startup Oz, which is being fronted by Scott Farquhar of Atlassian fame, really pushing back against the worst aspects of the bill. And by the looks of things, what they're demanding change is really, really sensible.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they've got real concerns, and Atlassian is a great example of an Australian company that has a real global reach that, you know, would be, I guess, you know, have a bunch of customers that are quite concerned about what the impact of this would be. So yeah, seeing organized pushback, I think, is you know, not really a surprise, but, you know, maybe the Australian government, you know, the legislators involved, and, you know, I don't know whether they're expecting this degree of organized response.
Well, I mean, they've got four key recommendations, right? And they're all entirely reasonable recommendations that I 100% agree with. They're saying that compulsory notices requiring individual employees to build new capabilities to intercept communications should be scrapped. Now, I will say that capability in the legislation is like, it's kind of stretching already, but it should be made clear that that's not a thing that can happen. They want the definition of companies deemed to be designated communications providers tightened to only include specific communication providers, and they want oversight on how companies are targeted, and they want the definition of what constitutes a serious offence to be... They want this reserved for more serious offences than those that carry 3 years in prison. So finally, we've got some organised resistance here to the worst parts of the bill. I know this is like suboptimal because it's already passed, but we are going to have a change. And of course, the government is being pretty bad about this now. They were like, no, well, it's passed, it's done, you know, even though they promised to revisit it this year. But look, we're heading to a federal election in May this year, and it's all going to come down to what the Labor Party does once they get into government. And I really hope they don't drop this. I really hope that they don't get into government and go, well, what's done is done, but let's see. Also in Australia, Vanessa Teague has been in the news, Dr. Vanessa Teague, saying that the government has declined to reissue a cryptography research permit that would allow her to contact foreign academics. Since then, there's been additional reporting that suggests that maybe this was an accident and the permit might be reissued. So we're not going to dwell on that one. We'll just see what happens. You know, contrast that to the Swiss approach here, Adam, where the Swiss government has essentially started a bug bounty for its e-voting system. This is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, this is an excellent idea. And obviously, you know, voting in Switzerland is a pretty key part of their, you know, more direct democracy. So having, you know, robust voting systems that are also usable in a convenient way is a, you know, a really important thing for them. So I think, yeah, more than most nations, they have a real focus on making this process work well and be robust. And yeah, bug bounty approach seems like a pretty good idea. So go them.
Oh, and finally, Adam, a dating app did the classy thing of like leaving everyone's photos in an S3 bucket or something. So they were like dick pics galore, dick pics for everyone.
Dear, oh dear. Yeah, this is unfortunately fairly normal for these kinds of organizations that run a bunch of dating networks. All the private images from private chats and other things were, yeah, just dumped in the same S3 buckets, incremental IDs, got scraped. Just not good.
Adam, that is it for the week's news, or really the last 2 weeks' news. Thanks a lot for joining us, man. And we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. It was a jumbo week this week. Hopefully next week we'll have nice peace and quiet. Nothing will be awful.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the security news of the last couple of weeks. Big thanks to him for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Michelle Price, the Chief Executive of OstCyber. OstCyber is an Australian non-profit organisation that operates on sweet, sweet government grants. And their job is to foster the growth of the Australian cybersecurity industry and sector. One thing they're going to do this year is run a side event at RSA. That actually sounds like it'll make for a wonderful escape from the main trade floor. You'll hear about that in a minute. And then Michelle and I are going to actually have a chat about Australia's assistance and access bill. You just heard us speaking about that in the news. Now, the bill is a bit of a mess, in my view, and certainly in Michelle's. And there's a lot of industry pressure now to tidy it up. And Michelle is certainly in that camp that believes the bill needs reform. She'll tell us why in just a moment. But first up, Michelle's going to tell us all about the OstCyber side event at RSA this year. Be there or be square. Oh, and I did ask too, and they really are doing shrimp on the barbie. This is a thing they're doing. Bless their cotton socks. Anyway, here's Michelle.
We are hosting a side event. So this year for the RSA conference itself, we've got Australia House, which is just located a block and a half away from the Moscone Centres. And at Australia House, absolutely, it's all about putting a shrimp on the barbie and making sure that San Francisco can actually have a taste of good coffee and bringing some of our best and brightest Australian entrepreneurs in cybersecurity to showcase our capabilities.
Man, you managed to get a cliche and a burn into your first comment. That's great. So Australia House, what is Australia House?
Australia House is a sort of setup where we've got, space for companies to do business, Australian companies to be able to sit down with prospective customers, but also to network with potential customers that are in the broader sort of cross-sectoral space of cyber going into all sectors of the economy. To talk about what they have to offer that's unique, but also how they can supplement through supply chains, but also through direct partnerships into the US market. But obviously, there's lots of other countries that attend the RSA conference, so it's not just about the US market. It's also all of the rest of the world, really. In addition to that, it's also talking to investors and talking to governments and educators about all things cyber.
And you did this already last year, didn't you? You actually had this same side event at, Australia House. Where is it, by the way? Like, is this like a function center or something that you booked out near Moscone, or how does this work?
Yeah, so last year we did do it as a bit of a kind of test to see how much traffic we could extract away from the expo hall at RSA, and word spread pretty quickly.
I can't imagine it'd be that hard. I mean, you know, I've been to RSA and I would love to escape, you know, to somewhere a bit smaller.
That's exactly the idea. It's a bit of respite and doing business while we give respite with the shrimps and the coffee. But we did test it last year and we had really good foot traffic coming through in addition to our schedule that we had of panels that, you know, educate the US market and broader markets about Australian capability. So we're at Minna Gallery, which is about, like I said, a block and a half away off towards, you know, as you go down towards the water, away from the city. But, you know, a 3-4 minute walk away from Moscone Centre's, you know, in Australia House, we've got the entire gallery space booked out for the entire week. And so people can drop by pretty much any time. I mean, we know that we're not going to extract people away from the parties, and we probably will be going to the parties ourselves, but during business hours, certainly there'll be a lot going on that will be, you know, giving something for everyone, really, a taste of Australia.
Yeah. So is that 111 Minna?
Yes.
Great space. Well done organising that. So how many people have you actually got coming along? How many Australian companies are actually going to be there at 111 Minna?
Yeah, so we've got 50 companies with us this year, which is up on last year. We love to always go bigger every year. In addition to the companies, though, we've also got representatives from each of the Australian states and territories that can talk about incentives of how to come and set up shop in Australia. So that's a really important part of it. And in addition to that, we've also got...
Wow, so you're offering good coffee, shrimps from the Barbie, and tax incentives.
Absolutely. We're taking cues from other cyber centres around the world and finally catching up on the economic side of the equation. And, you know, states and territories actually also doing Team Australia. For the Australians out there, you know that that's actually a pretty hard endeavour to make happen, and that's a requirement from me that they must play Team Australia. And in addition to the states and territories, we've also got some of our best universities attending along as well. So the University of New South Wales, the Australian National University, and Edith Cowan University showcasing what they do as well.
Now, you mentioned panels. Like, what sort of panels can we expect to see?
Yeah, it's a really broad range of panels. Each day has a different theme. And so those panels focus in on sharing information, not just about what Australia has to offer in all of the different areas of cybersecurity capability, you know, from the usual to the unusual. You know, cyber education as a service perhaps is a bit more of the unusual these days. But also in terms of how Australia can partner with other countries as well as other companies, investors. So we've got panels that are focused on how to do the doing of onboarding new technology. And how Australian capability can be very agile relative to other offerings around the world. And that's sort of in the way that we do business, I think. Through to why cybersecurity investment is different to investment in other technology. You know, this sense around, you know, that cybersecurity needs both patient and hot capital at the right times to really make the scaling process happen effectively. So it's both about educating as well as absorbing new information and looking at the landscape through an Australian lens.
That's interesting, right? So really what you've done here is you've set up a one-stop shop for all things Australia, right? So you're talking about, you know, investors come and see our technology, customers who are looking for, you know, potential customers who are looking for new tech come and see that, partners, you know, and indeed other companies that might be interested in setting up offices in Australia. I mean, you've got pretty much every base covered there. Even academia.
That's right, exactly right. So it's a very holistic approach. And part of what we see as the Australian advantage in what is obviously an enormous conference, you know, it's the biggest one in the world for the cybers, is that, you know, we know how to partner and we know how to integrate. And that's really what we're showcasing at the end of the day, is that cybersecurity really now is at the very foundation of every economy. How to do that effectively means that you need to integrate, and we think Australia does that really well.
Now, one thing I wanted to ask you about, the AA bill here in Australia, I mean, it's received some really hysterical coverage with people saying, oh, the Australian government is going to compel individual developers to subvert their companies and, you know, and that stuff's, you know, frankly, not true. But nonetheless, you know, Australia seems to have a bit of stink on it at the moment because of this bill. I mean, is that something that you're noticing? Is this something that you're having to talk about in your day-to-day?
Absolutely, yes, it is. And, you know, there's a couple of reasons for that. I think that to your point, you know, there is a bit of hysteria out there. And, you know, age-old story around technology and hysteria is that that occurs when we don't know what's going to happen. And so the one thing that I'm spending my time talking about when I get asked about the now is sort of almost infamous AA bill is that, you know, there's still a lot that needs to be worked through. And yes, absolutely, the Australian government could have done more to provide information to industry around what how this would operate in practice. That's where they're up to right now, is that they are drafting industry guidelines to really work through to the last layer of detail. And we know, obviously, given that the way that the legislation is worded, there's a lot of detail that's involved in operationalising this legislation. But I might sort of note here that actually it was a bill that amended legislation. It's not, it didn't create new legislation. So one of the things that's sort of less known or less appreciated is that the bill actually amended or sought to amend 14 pieces of legislation. This doesn't happen overnight. There's still so much detail that has to be worked through. So what we do need to do as a country is certainly sort of come together and make sure that, you know, the detail gets worked through in a pragmatic and practical way, so that given we are living with the reality of this being in place now, that's the reality that we're working with now. How do we try and sort of work through the detail of it? So it is occupying a fair bit of my time at the moment, yes.
I'd imagine also just sitting down with, like, you know, maybe doing a hand puppet show or something and actually walking through, you know, the intent of the legislation, how it's expected to work, might assuage some fears. The one thing that I find really strange about this is it, you know, it really closely mirrors the UK Investigatory Powers Bill, and yet you don't hear the same things said about the UK, which is, oh, you won't be able to trust UK developers anymore. It's a bit weird.
Yeah, and I think that you're absolutely right. I think there are two reasons for that. And one is that, firstly, there was a 12-month industry consultation process for the UK's approach to this. So it was a very different environment as to how that was born, if you like. And so we've kind of got a bit of a reverse process going on with the Australian situation.
Then do the consultation afterwards, yeah.
Well, there was consultation in the Australian situation, but it wasn't broad consultation. So, you know, there was some industry associations and some of the more mature organisations within the Australian economy did contribute to the industry consultation process here. But it certainly wasn't a consultation process that was broadly known. And, you know, I think it is reflective of the Australian level of maturity across the economy at the moment. We are still relatively and comparatively immature. And so most did not understand that this was something that they did need to have a think about and could have contributed to a process that did exist, albeit comparatively short when you look at the UK process.
I think also that, you know, it's a weird thing with Australia, right, is we got some absolutely insane laws on the books and they're never enforced. They're never enforced, like, in a crazy way. Like, we happen to have, like, a justice system that tends to use, for the most part, right, use common sense application, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's why, yeah, I don't know. It's just a little bit of a quirk to Australian society that I've noticed. Like, you don't wind up with, like, you know, a felony conviction and doing hard time for getting drunk and stealing a bicycle in Australia, which is something that can happen in other countries, right?
That's right. And so I think that sort of fair go, you know, definitely that sort of, you know, principle of innocence and that, you know, this sort of, taken on its merits. I think that, you know, what this was, the whole process around the AA bill and how it came to pass, I mean, the actual specifics of how it passed in Parliament was unprecedented. That's one thing. But in terms of the consultation process, it sent a very loud signal to organisations like ours and to industry associations and also to governments, plural, so not just the federal government but also the states and territories, that we really do need to do more to help uplift the economy's understanding of what the role of policy, regulation, and legislation is in a digital world, and that we've been sort of the first cap off the rank in the cybers. So I think that, you know, the UK situation was different because they had a greater level of maturity within their economy to start with around digital issues and the intermingling of the cybers, but also the consultation process was a little bit different. On the other side of things, I think there's a second factor as to where we are different to the UK process, and that's the judicial oversight built into their process that's a bit different to ours. And I think that that's where, in my personal view, I think that that's where we'll see some focus around the review that's happening in the parliamentary process at the moment.
Yeah, and we should point out to listeners from outside of Australia, we are probably going to have a change of government around May this year, it would be. Although the Labor Party is very good at snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. They've done it before. I believe they can do it again. But look, I mean, you know, my read on that bill is that, yeah, it needs work. It's a flawed bill. Fundamentally, you know, we're going to wind up with something that's fundamentally, in effect, the same thing, but that will maybe keep industry a little bit happier. You know, that's my feeling. Is that the sense that you get as well?
It absolutely is, Pat. And I think that what we also need to appreciate when we do kind of calm our farm for a little bit, this is a new reality. It's not just a case of saying that, you know, this legislation or, you know, the changes across the 14 pieces of legislation, let's, you know, sort of make that point. The changes are you know, they do feel rough right now. There's no two ways about that. But when we look at the longer term trajectory of how the Western world is tracking, we know that the UK has got similar legislation. New Zealand does also have similar legislation. And so, you know, we are just the latest country, you know, maybe the third or fourth country to kind of do this. There's many other countries to come after us. We will end up with a more consistent regime at the end of the day, at some point within the next 5 to 10 years, where the trade environment, you know, sort of the buying and selling of the cybers in amongst this environment will adjust. It's not great, but it is the world that we live in because, you know, there's a lot of badness. And, you know, as I said yesterday when I was speaking at a conference to the events sector, the cyberspace is still the badlands that, you know, the physical world had sort of, you know, a couple of centuries ago. So
it sounds like what you're trying to say here is that, you know, at the moment, you know, it's something that you're having to talk about, but you would expect that this is more of a blip than something that's going to cause some sort of long-term disadvantage to Australian trade.
Yeah, absolutely. That is how I see it. I genuinely do see that, and I don't want to diminish sort of, you know, the pain that companies are going through right now in sort of trying to figure out, in the absence of industry guidelines, what this needs to look like in operation. I do not want to diminish that. We do need to work through the detail of that and make good on the opportunity to shape and influence those guidelines. Really, really important. So for all of the AusCybers out there listening to this, get involved, please get involved. But I do think over the next 2-3 years, we're going to see a levelling out here. The playing field for Australia will level out because other countries are going to go down this path. And, you know, we're already seeing a significant amount of interest in Australian capability from the Brits. You know, their environment is similar to ours now as a result of our legislation, legislative changes coming to pass, but also they're dealing with a whole range of circumstances that makes Australia look pretty happy right now. You know, Brexit is really tough for them, and our cyber capability can do a lot to help them.
Wow.
So we'll see.
You had to mention Brexit as well.
That does not mean that we don't. I did. There's opportunity in Brexit for Australian cyber capability.
That's something.
Yeah, so we will see a levelling out. That does not mean that it's not painful right now. I certainly do appreciate that, and I am feeling that pain as well.
All right. Well, Michelle Price, you know, let's just wrap it up by telling everyone, get down to 111 Minna in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Go to the Minna Gallery. Go see what Australia has to offer, whether you're an investor, a customer, whether or not you just want to actually taste what good coffee tastes like. You know, get down there, say hello to Michelle and her crew. But Michelle Price, thank you very much for joining us on the show and for being this week's sponsor. Really appreciate it.
Really great to be part of it. Thanks, Pat.
That was Michelle Price of AusCyber there with a chat about a couple of things. The AusCyber side event at 111 Minna around RSA and the AA bill. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. But until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.